listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Senator Sanders, do you believe that God is relevant?
Well, the answer is yes. And I think when we talk about God, whether it is Christianity or Judaism or Islam or Buddhism, what we are talking about is what all religions hold dear. And that is to do unto others as you would like them to do unto you.
Secretary Clinton, to whom and for whom do you pray?
I pray for the will of God to be known so that we can know it and to the best of our limited ability, try to follow it and fulfill it. You know, I am a praying person, and if I hadn't been during the time I was in the White House, I would have become one.
Two of the final questions that were asked in the town hall slash debate that was held on Sunday night, the two candidates there, Secretary Hillary Clinton, Senator Bernie Sanders, asking and answering those questions respectively. One of the things they were talking about there, it's interesting. Do we need our politicians to answer more questions about their religious faith? Should we know more about their religious practice as well? It's a question that I'd like to pose as we talk again this week about the November elections. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc., our weekly update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, welcome back to you as well.
It's great to be here with you.
Molly, we just heard a question that was posed at the end of the Democratic debate on Sunday to both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. What did you make of both of the candidates' responses?
The questions were really easy questions to answer, and I thought they both did a pretty good job answering them, because it would be impossible to answer the question, is God relevant, with a negative. So even though Bernie Sanders is himself not religious, he's Jewish but not religious, he was able to answer that question in a way that resonates with a lot of voters who are religious. Hillary Clinton, likewise, she is known for being more religious in her liberal Methodist faith, but she is also tainted by scandal and whatnot. So by talking about for whom she prays and to whom she prays, she was able to soften her image somewhat. I really enjoy religion questions and debate, and I think they shed light on the candidates. I would like to see much more of that. But both answered in very civil religion ways. Bernie Sanders talked about the shared golden rule across different religions, that religion is about what you do, and Hillary Clinton's Methodism is not going to provide much of a counter to that. But I don't think this is really an election where people are that concerned about religious views, as you can tell from what's happening on the other side of the aisle as well.
Molly, you say you enjoy the religion questions. Do you think the presidential candidates should be asked more often about their religious beliefs, and in particular, maybe even pressed upon with follow-ups, about their practice of the religion? Do you go to church? Who's your pastor? How often do you go?
I would love questions like that. I think it's so interesting to see how people's religious views are manifested in their lives. And I'm not entirely sure that I would trust mainstream media people to do those. One thing I really enjoyed, I think, when was that Barack Obama and John McCain, I think, had a forum at Saddleback Community Church, which was hosted by Rick Warren, where he was able to drill down a little bit on some of those questions. The thing is that what people ask about religion is always going to be somewhat specific to what concerns them. Mainstream media are very bad at covering religion in any case, but I do wish there were more opportunities for people to talk about religion. Again, this is not just something on the Democratic side of the aisle, but on the Republican side as well, where you're seeing people who are much more religious are the most likely to be opposed to Donald Trump. I think that's an interesting divide, and I would like to see more questions asked, not just of the candidates, but of the voters. I'm curious about if we could get a little more information on who's going for Trump, who's not, and how that breaks down, not just by whether they identify themselves as Christian or evangelical, but what their actual religious practice is.
Both of you recently attended CPAC, and Molly, you were even a main stage panelist on the subject of homosexuality, and I want to get to that in a second. But Mark, what was your general impression of the mood at CPAC? This really is the who's who of American conservatives, especially in a presidential election year.
I think the mood was basically anxious. You saw that Donald Trump was supposed to appear on Saturday at CPAC, and he did not at the last minute. And I think that was because he properly sensed that there was going to be some sort of, you know, protest or some sort of, you know, people not respond to him the way that he wanted to. And supposedly the reports were that he specifically objected to having to take questions from the crowd. But, you know, having said that, I think it's interesting because, you know, people need to remember that even though Donald Trump appears to be, you know, winning the, well, doesn't appear to be, he is winning the most delegates of all the people in the race so far. He's still pretty much skating by with a plurality of the votes. His ceiling is about 35% of the popular vote, it seems to be, in the Republican primary. And the actual principled conservative portion of the party is not going away, and those are the people that are by and large, you know, against Trump. So the idea, I think, that Trump is completely remaking the Republican coalition, I think people are getting way out over their skis on that, and people need to slow down and actually see what happens with Donald Trump, because we don't see a big anti-incumbent movement like we saw with the Tea Party. It seems to be primarily about Trump. I mean, there isn't even a significant primary challenge to a senator in 2016 on the Republican side. So a lot of this talk about where everything revolves around Trump at this point in time, I think it's really early to tell whether that's the case. And I think CPAC was a good indicator of that, the actual sort of principled wing of the party, you know, that's about conservative values as opposed to Trump's nationalism and populism is still alive and well.
Molly, you were a main stage panelist on one day there at CPAC. What was the subject? And a lot of people were commenting that it was a subject that it was kind of had been waiting in the wings a long time at this conservative group.
Yeah, I just have to note that Mark was also a main stage panelist on a separate day talking about culture, but I got to talk about same-sex marriage, and that is a topic that had never been broached on the main stage at this conservative political action conference. And with the Obergefell decision, people on both sides of the issue really felt that the time had long since passed when it was appropriate to have a conversation on the main stage. What we had were two people who opposed redefining marriage to include same-sex couples. I was one of them. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation was the other. And then we had two people who support redefining marriage to include same-sex couples, Guy Benson, who's at Fox News and Town Hall, and Ilya Shapiro, who's a scholar at the Cato Institute. What really marked the conversation, in my view, is that we all agreed, whether we were on one side of this issue or another, we all agreed about the dire threats to religious freedom that are in play as a result of Obergefell. And this is something that the alarm was sounded by all four of the Supreme Court decision dissents, all four of the justices who wrote dissents to the Obergefell decision were really explicit that this was a very bad sign for religious freedom. And so people who are conservative and libertarian but disagree on this issue were in agreement that this is where people need to focus their efforts to preserve the liberty of people who are dissenting from this new belief about what marriage is.
Mark, tell us about your main stage panel topic.
Well, it was about what to do about the fact that the American left seems to have captured a lot of very influential institutions. And I was on a panelist with an actress in Hollywood and some other people that have insight into these particular institutions. But, you know, one point I did bring up that's relevant to what we've been discussing, which is that when people talk about the liberal capture of American institutions, they tend to talk about Hollywood, they tend to talk about higher education, and they tend to talk about the political apparatus to a certain extent. But one thing that rarely gets discussed in this context is what's happened to mainline Protestantism in this country, which is to say that actually starting around, you know, the 1960s, the same time all this other stuff was happening, liberals very much did their, you know, a long march through a lot of Protestant churches in this country that were once a sort of bulwarks of sort of cultural strength in this country. And as they made these, you know, national organizations for the churches more expressly and explicitly political, even in ways I think that are very contradictory to their theology, their influence has also declined, as has the membership of these churches. And that has really hurt these churches, and I think hurt the country at large, because now you have a situation here where, you know, even the supposed, you know, culturally conservative party is embracing a guy like Donald Trump, who, you know, is very unmoored in personal principle, and I think that and people don't really seem to care about that at all, or at least a significant portion of people supporting him don't. So I think that decline in religiosity because of the capture of certain religious institutions has in fact hurt this country a lot.
Mitt Romney made a speech in advance of CPAC that was televised nationally as well. He was rather critical of both Trump and his candidacy, essentially warning against that. What I'm wondering is, what's different or similar about Romney's conversion and Trump's conversion on social issues like abortion, natural marriage, etc.? They were both kind of, in their day, Romney 2012 and Trump 2016, recent converts to the right side of the social moral issues. Molly?
Romney's fairly recent changes on socially conservative issues, that was a big stumbling block for him getting the nomination among Republicans who just felt that they just didn't think he was as much of a stalwart on the topics as they wished he were. A lot of people also thought that his previous stances on social issues might have also been a calculation in order to get elected as a Republican in the very blue state of Massachusetts. But there's even with what a late adopter Mitt Romney was, he had a story that made sense, and he was able to talk about it and articulate it with some ability. With Donald Trump, I think he's truly just not a social conservative, and he doesn't make any pretense about being a social conservative. If he's forced to talk about abortion, he will. The other night, he had a press conference where someone asked him for his position on same-sex marriage. He told the reporter to sit down. He knows what his position is. I have no idea what his position is, by the way, but that was how he treated the reporter who asked about it. And we have a media that seems totally fine with not asking any tough questions about either the redefinition of marriage or the implications that we just talked about with regard to religious freedom. And so I think that it'll be interesting to see what Donald Trump answers, if he is ever asked these things, by our media that so enjoy covering him all day long.
Mark, same question to you. What's the difference or the similarity between Romney and Trump on those social issues at this point in their campaigns?
Well, I mean, I would just reinforce a lot of what Molly was getting at. I mean, the difference between in tone and sincerity is remarkable. You know, Mitt Romney had a very sort of complex, involved personal story that he could, you know, talk about at great length about why he changed his mind and what specific things he saw that you know, made him rethink his previous position on it and so on and so forth. Whereas Donald Trump is like, yeah, I'm pro-life, you know, whenever he's asked. And oh, by the way, even though I'm pro-life, I still think that, you know, Planned Parenthood does a whole lot of good, and, you know, I'm not backing down from that. It's just totally unconvincing, and it just seems insincere. And it's not just insincere because, you know, Trump is kind of a glib New Yorker. It's another one of these issues where he can't speak to any degree of specificity about the issue. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, he does this again and again. You know, even his main issue, immigration, allegedly, we were in a situation here with a day of the last debate where Donald Trump went into the debate with a position on immigration and H-1B visas, changed his position from the debate stage quite explicitly. I'm changing repeatedly, and said that we needed more high-skilled immigration. And then at the very end of the debate, his campaign issued a statement completely walking back everything he had just said. you know, if you care about social issues, the idea that Donald Trump is in any way sincere about, you know, what he's saying, you just can't hang your hat on that at all. I mean, he, you know, supposedly the issues that most mattered to him, like immigration, you can't even trust the guy. So I don't know what to say other than it's just, you know, Romney, again, had a lot of hurdles to overcome in convincing people, but he at least, you know, put the work in. Donald Trump won't even do that. He's literally just checking a box and not even doing so in a way that, you know, seems very, you know, serious.
Mark Hemingway is our guest, along with his wife, Molly Hemingway. Mark is senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Molly, senior editor for The Federalist. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether, at the national level, what's happening here with Trump and back in 2012 with Mitt Romney, a move to the right. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining The Issues, etc. 300, Trinity Lutheran, Bridgeton, Missouri, Calvary Lutheran, Elgin, Illinois, Advent Lutheran, Zionsville, Indiana, Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas, Holy Cross Lutheran, Albany, Oregon, St. John's Lutheran, Evanston, Indiana, Mount Calvary Lutheran, San Antonio, Texas, Good Shepherd Lutheran, Boise, Idaho, Village Lutheran, Ladue, Missouri, Emmanuel Lutheran, Osceola, Iowa, St. Paul Lutheran, Clarinda, Iowa, Trinity Lutheran, Lebanon, Missouri, Mount Calvary Lutheran, Excelsior Springs, Missouri, the Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California, Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Freeburg, Illinois, and Peace Lutheran, Neenah, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Support, the Issues Etc. 300.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Mark and Molly Hemingway are our guests on this Wednesday afternoon, March the 9th. We're talking about the November elections. Get our weekly update. Mark is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly is senior editor for The Federalist. I'm wondering whether we've noticed this for years now, that back in the day of Al Gore, Bill Clinton, Dick Gephardt, they started out as pro-life when they were kind of at the local level or the state level. When they entered national politics, they all became adamantly pro-choice. I wonder if a similar thing here is happening with Romney in 2012 and Trump in 2015.
I think it's really sad what happened with the pro-life movement and the Democratic Party. It was to the benefit of the Republican Party, of course, that the Democratic Party became hostile to pro-life voters. And a lot of them went to the Republican Party, even if they didn't agree with all of the other positions. The fact is that while the country does generally oppose abortion on demand, they are fairly moderate, I guess you would put it, in their views on abortion. They think it should be legal through the first trimester, and then they start being much more friendly to protections for the unborn children. But the people who care about this issue a great deal have been able to have a lot of sway in the Republican Party through a tremendous amount of hard work and effort. And if the big takeaway of this election is that you no longer need to show any deference to the pro-life contingent of the Republican Party, that might be the big legacy of Donald Trump and why it's so interesting that so many Christians are signing up to support him.
Let's talk about last night's primaries, Michigan, Mississippi, Idaho. What do we learn last night on both sides, beginning with the Republican side? Mark.
We learned that there was a lot of talk about how Trump's momentum had been slowed down in the wake of the last debate, where he kind of melted down and didn't have such a great night in the primaries that came immediately after that. But last night he, you know, certainly overperformed in Hawaii, and he had no trouble winning Michigan. So everybody is again, you know, thinking that the Trump chain is gathering steam if it was slowed down a little bit. That was, the big takeaway on the Republican side, which is that, you know, if you were thinking that Trump was not inevitable, well, there's more evidence to think that Trump is back in the driver's seat again. And then on the Democratic side, what happened in Michigan is extremely interesting, in part because not just did Bernie Sanders win Michigan, but I think the Real Clear polling average, which is where they take all of the polls that are done in the state and then they average out what the average lead is, was something like Hillary was going to win the state by 20 points. It was just unbelievable that Bernie Sanders won Michigan. And that tells us a couple of things. One, specifically about this Democratic race, which is that Bernie has won something like 40% of the delegates in the race thus far, and there's something like 30 states left to vote. So, you know, it could end up being a longer slog than Hillary anticipated to win this thing. But then there's another wrinkle, which is the Democratic Party has this thing called superdelegates, which is just incredibly undemocratic. They just basically allow party insiders to cast a vote, and Hillary's locked up a lot of those people. So that means that if Bernie is close in terms of, you know, what they call pledge delegates from having won elections, and they go into the convention and the margin is going to be, you know, possibly a matter of superdelegates, these party insiders deciding who the nominee is, then the Democratic convention could be really interesting. And then secondarily, the other thing, and this is true on both sides of the fence, Sanders' win in Michigan tells us a lot that polling, which has become this incredible, inescapable thing that dictates political coverage around the clock, is completely unreliable, and it has been for a long time. The polls were wildly off in 2014 races by 10 points or more in various Senate races, and now we're in a situation where, I mean, 20 points is to say that's outside the margin of error is you know, an understatement and a half. And not only that, on the Republican side of the situation, where even where there's a lot of states where Trump has even won, but the polls have still overstated Trump's lead by double digits in those states. So we really need to step back and take a look at polling as a means to determine, you know, who gets coverage and, you know, how much coverage, which seems to be kind of what's going on in political journalism.
Molly, what's your takeaway from last night's election results?
Very much the same thing about the polling and how staggering and stunning Bernie's victory in Michigan was. Although Mark and I are here in Michigan right now, and it's certainly true that the enthusiasm seemed to be with Bernie and not with Hillary, even if polls showed her 20 points ahead. I'm also struck by just how Marco Rubio continues to struggle to meet thresholds. It is not that he hasn't won states, because I don't think anyone really expected him to win that many states this early in the calendar. But his path to victory did need him to get some delegates from the states, and you have to meet a certain threshold in many states to be able to get any delegates. And had he done that in you know, even just at half of the states that he's been competing in, he would be in a much better position right now. It's just a really bad thing for him going into Florida that he can't make the argument that he is palatable to GOP voters. At the same time, another way to put it is that Ted Cruz's campaign has been very effective at hanging in there, even with this Donald Trump juggernaut that has so much support among the mainstream media and other figures. Donald Trump had a good night last night, but it wasn't great. He was under 50%, and that's in large part because of how effective efforts to stop Trump have been. So it's still definitely an open race. Donald Trump leads, but he still has a tough road to hoe. At this point in the campaign, the previous two Republican nominees pretty much had it much closer to locked up. Donald Trump is facing additional resistance as he continues. So I'll be curious to see what happens as we start heading into some of these winner-take-all states.
Well, with regard to that, Molly, is it possible for Donald Trump to lose his lead?
Absolutely. I think the one thing that people have to keep in mind is that nobody knows anything about what's happening this campaign season. And he could lose Florida and Ohio, and all of a sudden his road goes from being presumed nominee into a very tough, difficult thing. Or let's say just all the candidates drop out other than Cruz. You could have Cruz start sweeping up all these winner-take-all states. On the other hand, maybe Donald Trump, his efforts to moderate to other voters will work, and he'll start breaking out of some of that ceiling he's had. Nobody knows. Anything is still possible. And if you are heavily interested in Donald Trump winning or losing, there are plenty of plays.
I think you're starting to see glimmers that Republican voters and parts of the party apparatus are starting to think about defeating Trump in tactical terms. I would not have imagined a universe where Carly Fiorina would come out and endorse Trump the way that she did this morning. She always seems slightly more moderate necessarily than Cruz, but I think that she recognizes that Cruz is the best chance of stopping Trump. And similarly, you have somebody like Lindsey Graham, who's been, you know, quite open about the fact he doesn't even really like Cruz, but he, you know, has no problem getting behind him to stop Trump because he thinks that that is, you know, clearly the smarter, more rational thing to do. And, you know, and I think that that voters are starting to recognize that that's the case too. I mean, I know a significant amount of people who were here in Michigan, you know, voted for Kasich simply because they thought that Kasich was had the best chance of beating Trump in the state. It turned out Kasich and Cruz effectively tied in the state, which is, you know, good news for Cruz. But, you know, I think if people had known that Cruz is going to do better, they would have voted for him too. But I just think that people are thinking about voting to stop Trump as opposed to, you know, necessarily they feel enthusiastic about Kasich or whoever it is in a given state that is opposing him.
Mark, is it possible that Hillary Clinton could lose her lead?
Anything's possible.
She could be indicted, for instance.
Right. Like I said, there's still something like, you know, 30 states left to vote in the primary. And, you know, certainly what happened with Bernie Sanders in Michigan was a huge wake-up call in terms of, you know, I mean, Hillary didn't just try and win Michigan. I mean, she practically moved to Flint and made a massive issue out of the water crisis here and really, really put in her dues in Michigan and still lost the state. So, I mean, if you were in Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn right now, I mean, you know, it's got to be, you know, klaxons going off about what this means. It could possibly signal a big momentum shift worldwide. People see that, you know, Bernie Sanders has the ability to win a big, diverse, important state like Michigan. Well, then, you know, people might start thinking of him as more of an actual possibility rather than sort of the crazy socialist the Hillary campaign has tried to make him out to be. Again, if there's anything we've learned in this election cycle, which is do not make predictions about what's going to happen here because the voters seem to have a mind of their own.
Could Bernie Sanders decide to run as a third-party candidate, both of you, starting with Molly?
I'm not sure. I think that, you know, he's a new Democrat. He's, of course, always caucused with Democrats during his career. He's very consistent about his views, and he's, you know, however flawed they may be. And I could see that he has a lot of momentum. And if he senses, I don't know, I mean, there's so much enthusiasm for him. It seems far more unlikely that you're going to get a third party out of the Democratic side than out of the Republican side of the aisle. But I guess, again, anything is possible. I'm curious what Mark thinks.
Mark, about 30 seconds.
Well, the Democratic Party likes to play hardball. I mean, Bernie Sanders has already had to sue the Democratic Party to get access to, you know, the resources that the other candidates in the race have had and other things. I mean, they sensed that Hillary was threatened by him all along and have tried to keep him at arm's length. But having said that, Bernie is building a movement all to himself, and I don't think he wants to tarnish his legacy as being the guy that destroyed the Democratic Party's electoral chances. He knows that a lot of the Bernie voters and people that have organized for him, there's a very strong possibility they'll go on to organize in future Democratic primaries and future elections, and he can be proud of that legacy. So it seems very unlikely to me that he will run third party.
Folks, you can follow Mark Hemingway on Twitter at Heminator and Molly Hemingway on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks again for having me.
Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll find Christ in Zechariah chapter 11 with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. We'll continue our series responding to liberal proof texts, talk with Pastor Thomas Winger about Ephesians 1 and ecumenism. The Issues Etc. book of the month for March is Teaching the Faith at Home. What does this mean? How is this done? The title pretty much says it all, but the value of teaching our children from the very beginning the Christian faith in the home and then bringing them to the Lord's house is what is extolled in this Issues Etc. book of the month. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, Teaching the Faith at Home. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Cradled in historic Perry County, Missouri, the manger of the Missouri Synod, Emmanuel Lutheran Church at 453 Northwest Street in Perryville proclaims God's Word and celebrates His Supper on Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 7:30 and 10 using the church's liturgy contained in Lutheran Service Book, enriched with ancient and modern hymns. For more information, call 573-547-8317 or visit www.emmanuel-perryville.org.